I'm Margaret Brennan, and welcome to Facing Forward. This week, spring back. The global economy is set to expand at the fastest pace in decades. Vaccines and trillions in pandemic-related government spending give a much-needed shot in the arm.
We've decided to go big because we think that the risks are of severe scarring if we allow there to be long-term unemployment.
But a new report by the International Monetary Fund warns of an unequal recovery around the world.
We expect to see 95 million or more enter extreme poverty because of this crisis. Clearly, these are losses that we cannot afford to suffer.
And how will the U.S. and other rich countries pay for their recent spending sprees? Just ahead, a conversation with Geeta Gopinath, chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, part of the financial arm of the UN that gives economies on the verge of collapse a lifeline.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you can have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Geeta Gopinath, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
So we were reading in, and one of the things that stood out was this Vogue magazine profile of you calling you a feminist icon. What is it like to be the first chief economist at the IMF who happens to be a woman?
Well, I mean, it's a tremendous honor to have this position, though I don't think they had to wait this long to get a woman to be a chief economist. There were many wonderful economists, women economists that preceded me could have done this job just as well. So I'm actually very, you know, grateful to Christine Lagarde, who was a former managing director who hired me there and said, you know, it's about time that we end this male dominance in chief economist roles.
So how do you explain, or how did you explain what the IMF does to your mother when you got the job?
I think it's going to be impossible, but there is something I can point to her as an example, because in 1991, when India had a financial crisis, at that time, the IMF had come into India and provided financing, and that was actually the start of some very important reforms in India. So she has heard of the IMF in that sense, and she, you know, I could jog her memory, and she was like, "Ah, yes, now I remember."
Okay, so I mean, for listeners, just to set the table, so the institution you help run as chief economist was created basically to help keep the global economy stable and to avoid the kind of disasters that we saw contribute to World War II. So times of crisis is really what the IMF was created to help avoid or get us out of. So like a year ago, we're all standing on the brink of the abyss with this great lockdown, as you called it. And now a year later, you are looking at the world and saying we're going to grow, that the economy is actually looking like it's headed in a positive direction. What went right?
Lots of things were really tough about last year in terms of the pandemic and the lives that were lost. But what did go right was that policy support really stepped up. And the mistakes that were made after the global financial crisis were not repeated again. There was about $16 trillion that were deployed and put in the system, way more than anything that was done after the global financial crisis. And I think that was one very important measure that helped put a floor on the collapse, including what central banks did, of course, in preventing a global financial crisis this time around. So I think these measures were really important to bring the world back from the brink of even greater collapse, and you know, we avoided the Great Depression.
So when you look at what happened after COVID-19 and that recession, you've said it's likely to leave smaller scars than the 2008 global financial crisis. So when I think back to the crisis, the thing that I think sticks with a lot of Americans is how long it took to recover the jobs. It took a decade in America to regain that ground. How long do you think it'll take America this time to get back to even?
Right now, based on our projections, that should happen next year in terms of bringing back the unemployment rate to where it was pre-pandemic and also bringing back some of the workers who left the labor force because they just lost hope. So to bring back the labor force participation rate. So I think next year would be the year when we would see a fairly full recovery in the U.S. labor market.
So this is before we factor in the trillions more in spending that the Biden administration is now proposing Americans help pump into the U.S. economy. Do you think what you're seeing with this growth is real, that it's not just a sugar high?
Now, given the large number of people who are unemployed, and just looking for work, there is a lot of what we call slack in the economy, many people who have lost their livelihoods, and they need to be brought back. They need to regain their jobs. Women have been hard hit. We need to bring back women into the workforce. So the spending that's been done to bring back a strong recovery, fast recovery, is real. I mean, it is what we will see in terms of improved employment numbers, improved livelihoods, improved income. So, this was needed.
Growth, though, you're saying, around the world isn't going to be even. It's not going to be clear sailing for everyone. You've called it the Great Divergence. What are the consequences of that, of this being kind of an uneven global recovery?
What this is doing, if you look at our projections for different parts of the world, you know, while advanced economies in the U.S. included are expected to do just fine, we have emerging markets and low-income countries that are getting hit very hard in terms of per capita income losses. And this is really troubling because it's reversing the progress that was made over the last couple of decades in terms of reduction in poverty. We expect to see 95 million or more enter extreme poverty because of this crisis. Clearly these are losses that we cannot afford to suffer. And similarly, as you're going to see lack of convergence in prospects for countries around the world. Before this crisis, we had many emerging and developing economies that were converging to rich country income levels, and that has been set back severely by this crisis.
What parts of the world are you worried about?
If you look at the Latin America region as a whole, and you look at the hit to their output or their income in 2024 relative to where they would have been in the absence of the pandemic, we're talking about losses of around 6-7% of GDP. Similarly, in emerging Asia, excluding China, that hit is around 8%. Sub-Saharan Africa, the losses are around 6-7%. So, you know, in many parts of the world, we are seeing these kinds of long-term scarring effects. Which is really troubling because most of these countries already are starting out at lower per capita income levels than, of course, the rich world.
Mm-hmm. And in real world terms, that means it's tougher to put food on the table. That means it's really impacting people's ability to survive. What kind of political implications are you seeing here? Are you predicting instability?
We're not predicting instability at this point, but if we don't rectify this great divergence, and if people, you know, if countries actually fall back tremendously in terms of increased poverty, then that would lead to social unrest, and that is a major issue. It can lead to geopolitical concerns, and so that is something that the world needs to worry about. Which is why we said now is the time for the international community to do everything it can to prevent this great divergence.
Social unrest, I mean, that can mean a lot of different things. Here in America, after the financial crisis, there was like this massive distrust of institutions. You know, you had the Tea Party movement, you had Occupy Wall Street on, you know, both sides of the political divide. In Europe, you had nationalist groups that kind of came to the fore. Do you think we know yet what the impact of this recession driven by the pandemic will be? Do we have a sense yet?
You know, we have a sense. Yes, we do. We have, our projections for the amount of scarring that will happen. And this time around, it's in advanced economies. It's projected to be quite small relative to, again, after the global financial crisis. But that said, you know, we still have the pandemic. It isn't over yet. And if there is a newer virus mutation that makes the vaccines ineffective, then that, I think, is a huge downside risk. And so if we have an even longer prolonged pandemic, I think we're looking at much more severe problems. That's why the number one priority has to be everywhere in the world to get vaccinations done.
So it's the virus and the vaccine that determine everything right now.
Absolutely. I think it has been the case for the last year and over that.
So we had the co-head of COVAX, you know, with part of this global initiative to get vaccines into countries around the world. He was with us on Face the Nation, and he said they've placed billions of, you know, orders for billions of doses. They've got billions of dollars in financial support, but they can't actually get their hands on vaccine.
The majority of those are coming in the second half of the year. And in the first half of the year, there, because of vaccine nationalism, has meant that there are less doses available. So that's our biggest challenge now. If we had more doses, we could make those available.
How significant a delay is something like that to how you see the world?
I think this is extremely costly. Crunched some numbers and we said, if you could get vaccinations to go much faster, then that would add $9 trillion to the global economy between now and 2024. And about 40% of that $9 trillion would be a benefit to advanced economies that would come from just bringing back all parts of the world from the abyss. And so it is a big loss. Every month of delay is a big loss to the global economy and, of course, to individual lives. This is, again, in terms of the absolute top agenda items, both at the national and the international level, just getting vaccinations, much more widespread vaccinations, is just absolutely at the top.
Keita, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
We're working with G20 nations to agree to a global minimum corporate tax rate that can stop the race to the bottom. Together, we can use a global minimum tax to make sure the global economy thrives based on a more level playing field in the taxation of multinational corporations and spurs innovation, growth, and prosperity.
So the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said this week that one way the Biden administration plans to pay for at least part of this proposed trillions of new spending packages that they're going to put forward by proposing a global minimum corporate tax rate. to the average person at home, that doesn't really sound like anything concrete. Gita, do you have any idea how this would work?
So the IMF actually has for a while been arguing for the need to have a global minimum corporate tax rate. What that basically means is where all nations in the world agree that the corporate rate at which they tax their corporations, there will be some minimum level above which their rates will be. So it's not as if there's a race to the bottom and everybody is not trying to bring down tax rates to the lowest possible level, because what that means is you end up with companies basically, shifting their locations artificially to benefit from lower tax rates. And so to avoid this kind of race to the bottom, having a floor in terms of having a common minimum level of corporate taxation would be very valuable.
So this is to stop companies from essentially shopping around for a cheaper deal in another country.
That's right. Exactly. And so then going and look, in some sense, doing the financial engineering that's needed so that they end up paying very low taxes in some part of the world, quite disconnected from where it is that they actually make a lot of their revenues.
So isn't there a downside, though, in some ways? I mean, like Ireland, for example, has this 12.5% corporate tax rate. The U.S. is talking about raising the global minimum to 21%. If you raise it, doesn't that hurt countries, smaller countries like Ireland that basically, rely on having these companies come to them because they charge this lower rate?
Well, there is indeed this very challenging issue of what exactly should be the corporate tax minimum rate. And indeed, 21% would be high relative to what we're seeing around the world. Now, we don't have a prescription in terms of what that number should be, but to get to cooperation and actually to get countries to agree on any kind of a minimum, obviously, they will have to negotiate with each other to agree on what that level should be. But yes, this is not an easy, agreement to make happen at all for the reasons that you just mentioned.
Right. So the Biden administration's proposal here is based on a premise of something that's actually already really complicated to get to. This is not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination yet.
No, it's not. It's certainly not. No.
So the U.S. is the largest financial contributor to the IMF. And for Americans who, are frustrated with what's happening in their own backyard right now, and they see supporting institutions like the IMF as kind of subsidizing the rest of the world, how do you explain to them why what the IMF is doing is necessary?
Well, I would just say that it's absolutely crucial for the health of the U.S. economy, for the people in the U.S. in terms of their jobs and their livelihoods, what is happening in the rest of the world. The U.S. trades with many countries. It receives investments from different parts of the world. And so having a healthy global economy, having everybody else outside the U.S., being in a healthy setup is very, very important for the economic prosperity of the U.S. And also not, to avoid geopolitical crises, tensions around the world, again, from a security perspective, too. I think it's very important to have a world that is prosperous and is stable, which is what exactly the IMF strives to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this crisis will change how governments around the world respond to economic problems like this? I mean, it kind of blows my mind when you think of how much money we are talking about right now. We've kind of normalized the word trillion. There have been trillions of dollars spent to dig us out of this hole. Like, what do we have a sense yet of how things have changed?
Indeed, I think there is a big sea change in the desire, the capacity, the demands on governments to step up. And in this crisis, they did many things that were right and were absolutely essential for dealing with this crisis. I mean, the way I think about it is there is a lot of unfinished business that the governments had even preceding this crisis, which is to make sure that all people in their country have access to basic public services like universal healthcare, you know, high quality education, and a good social safety net. And we know that countries that had all of this have been able to deal with this pandemic much better than those that did not. And so again, I would hope that coming out of this crisis, countries will finish this business of providing basic public services at the level and quality that's needed, making sure that you have a way of supporting poorer households, that they get the right kinds of opportunities, that you actually bring down inequality, which has gone up quite substantially. So, you know, this is the direction in which the world is moving towards building a more greener, more inclusive, economies.
So it's not just getting back to even, it's totally remaking the system in some ways.
I think it has accelerated what needed to be done. And inequality preceded this crisis, climate change preceded this crisis. But I think everybody now realizes that these cannot be left unaddressed. And I see this as quite a fundamental change after this crisis.
We have Janet Yellen, the first female Treasury Secretary, who before that was the first female head of the Federal Reserve. Christine Lagarde, head of the European Central Bank, head of the IMF, also female. And we're in a crisis that has impacted women in a way we just have not seen before in history. What do you make of that kind of unique timing? Do you feel like there's a reason that all of this is kind of coming together at once? Do you feel like you need to use your position to fix this particular part of the problem?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the big pluses of having women in senior positions is that they scream out when there are issues that affect women specifically. I think that's been a problem in the past. So I think there's a very strong common message coming out of multiple institutions saying that women are being harder hit in this crisis. You will need to provide targeted support. When you have the recovery going on, it's not enough to say that, okay, the unemployment rate has come down. You have to make sure that women are coming back into the labor force, that they haven't left the labor force on a permanent basis, that they are absolutely essential for the recovery for the global economy. And so I think, these are the messages we will continue to put out there. And my hope is that, concrete actions will be taken.
The World Economic Forum said it was like a generation of progress that has been lost. Do you have that dire prediction for women?
I don't think so. I mean, I am, of course, deeply concerned by the lost, jobs of women and the fact that because they still continue to be the main caregivers, whenever schools have shut down, they are the ones who've been most hard hit. But again, what we are seeing in terms of the recovery is that as contact intensive services sectors are reopening, your restaurants are reopening, people are traveling again, these are sectors that hire a lot of women, and you can see that women employment rates are coming back up. So I remain optimistic that we can fix this. And just like we are trying in every other dimension not to leave big scars from this crisis, I think, again, this in the matter of women, that is one area in which we're also working very hard.
Geeta Gopinath, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Margaret.
We're going to take a quick break.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now to an underreported issue. White evangelical Christians are among one of the largest religious communities in the U.S. least likely to get the COVID vaccine. According to a recent Pew Research Center survey, 45% of that group say they definitely or probably would not get the vaccine. Skepticism remains high in the community, and the reasons vary. Postings on social media show objections to the distant connection to aborted fetal tissue, particularly with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Others distrust the federal government and pharmaceutical companies, or just object to vaccination on religious grounds.
My name is Curtis Chang. I'm a former pastor. Our video series seeks to help Christians think biblically about the vaccine.
Church leaders like Curtis Chang are stepping up to persuade followers to take the shot.
It's important to think about the vaccine from a Christian perspective because a sizable number of believers have indicated they're suspicious of the vaccine.
This month, the Ad Council announced a new partnership with a COVID collaborative and Chang's project, ChristiansandTheVaccine.com. CBS News has learned that the Biden administration has started partnering with faith leaders to help them reach congregants. So far, only 19% of the total population is fully vaccinated. Dr. Fauci estimates that reaching herd immunity will require 70 to 90% of the population to comply. Overcoming vaccine hesitation is key to putting the pandemic behind us. Thank you for listening to Facing Forward. New episodes are available every Friday. Join us each week as we make sense of our changing world together. I'm Margaret Brennan. You can also find me on your CBS Network broadcast station Sunday mornings on Face the Nation or on our digital network CBSN at 10:30 a.m., 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. Sundays or through our Paramount Plus app. Facing Forward is produced by Face the Nation's Ann Hsu, Richard Escobedo, and Kelsey Miklas. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platforms and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.